Welcome to the Pint and Click podcast. I'm Dave. I'm your host, along with Jamie and Tony, as always. And we're here to talk about books and movies and all things meta today. Now, meta is a funny word. It means several things. It means a lot of different media. But let's talk about what is meta. What's something that's meta? Tony, what do you think?
I think the main definition I would say is like it actually is self-aware of the medium it's delivering maybe its message to. So it's a little intelligent or it behaves like the story maybe itself behaves in a way that draws attention to how it's being delivered to you. So it could be, you know, a song about songs, a book about books, a movie about movies, or I don't know. What do you think, Jamie?
Yes, so like we were thinking of some other references that would be popular ones, and I was thinking of Deadpool because he refers to himself, he speaks to the audience, he's self-aware of that it's this action movie, the superhero movie, or like in The Office when they say, are you still rolling? Things like that, where it shows an awareness of the format that it's in. Mm-hmm. It's not going directly to the audience, but it's mediated by the fact that there's this like higher level of awareness of realizing what it is.
Yeah, something that operates on multiple levels, I think, is key to the idea of something that's meta, and specifically that layer that engages the audience directly, the layer that says, this is a movie, this is a book, where you can't ignore that there is a character turning and speaking to the camera, or there's an author referring to a reader, maybe even just a narrator if they're trying to engage you directly is a good example of something that's meta. Maybe, maybe not. But we're looking at things that are meta today, and we're going to have some individual discussions, and then we're going to move on to House of Leaves at the end, which is a book that we're doing a book discussion about at an upcoming Pint and Click. So let's start off with Jamie. Jamie, what do you have that's meta for us?
So I'm talking about The Garden of Forking Paths by Jorge Luis Borges, and that one is one of the, I would say, texts of things that are in this idea of both metafiction, but also fiction that kind of deviates from being one specific journey or one specific plot. It's called The Garden of Forking Paths because it's both about a story that can move in different directions and not just one linear beginning and end, but then also the greater narrative in the story itself is. So it's meta because at the beginning of the story, it references itself. It talks about a specific incident in history in World War I. But actually, there's this gap in this history that most people don't know about, and the following text will tell you why, kind of. So it's referring to itself as a document. The story is kind of complicated, so I'm just going to distill it. It's talking about this Chinese spy who's working for the Germans, and he's running away from this British operative who's following him, and he's trying to get a message to his German handler in Berlin. And he's in London, and he's thinking about how can I get this message across. So he finds this one man in the phone book, and he goes to his house, and he finds out that this man whose house he's going to is a distinguished professor of Chinese history. And he finds out that this man, this professor he meets, actually knows a lot about the Chinese spy's ancestor. And this ancestor, so here we have like multiple levels we're going through because we're having stories within stories. The ancestor had two goals in life, and one was to create a wonderful epic novel, and the other one was to create a labyrinth that no one could escape from. And everyone thought that this ancestor failed because he never created the labyrinth, and then the novel he left afterwards was incomprehensible. It was like fragments here and there. There was no storyline. The protagonist would be alive in one chapter, dead, and then he would be alive again. So no one ever thought it made any sense. So that's what the Chinese spy always thought of his ancestor. But the professor is actually saying, well, actually, the book is the labyrinth. They weren't two separate quests. They were one and the same quest. And that this book is the labyrinth because there is multiple options, multiple futures. You can go whichever way you want. You can follow whichever path. So the arcs are infinitive. Then, after he does this, the Chinese spy feels very warmly towards him about illuminating this. But then he also kills him. He kills him because we realize at the end that the name of this professor was the name of the town of the information that the spy wanted to give the information to his handlers. And after he killed him, after he was captured, they put the name of the Chinese spy and the name of his victim in the newspaper, and that's why his handler could then see that, oh, the name is the place that the British operatives are located. That's the information he was trying to pass on.
I see.
Yeah. So That sounds a little complicated, and there's a lot more complexity in it than I'm distilling right now, but I think conceptually it's really interesting because that was one of the first times that this idea of multiplicity in fiction was really discussed in a fiction itself instead of an essay or something like that. Mm-hmm. And I guess that moves into the other thing I was thinking about, which is this idea of ergodic literature, which again goes back to House of Leaves, because ergodic literature is literature where non-trivial effort is required to allow the reader to traverse the text. Mm-hmm. Which means it's not just like a complicated book. It's not just a book that you have to think about a lot. But it's a book where the reader becomes an active participant or an active user in mm-hmm. the text. For your choices you're making, kind of reflect on the content you're receiving. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of what I feel like House of Leaves is. Mm. I can talk a little bit more about that later, but
of course.
That's what I'm going to say now.
So I'm looking at this. Is this a short story? Is this a novel, The Garden of Forking Paths?
It's a short story. It's mm-hmm. about 6 pages.
Okay.
And this is a topic that Borges comes back to again and again. He has another short story called The Library of Babel, and he was a librarian himself as mm-hmm. well as being a prolific writer. But it seems that he has this idea of time looping around and, you know, the Star Trek idea of having all these different timelines mm-hmm. simultaneously. And what would happen to that if that happened with books and with literature? Mm-hmm. I liked it because it talks about it, the subject itself, while also the fiction short story is an example of what he's talking about. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's really impressive when in a small amount of space, he can interest you in a topic. Like, I wouldn't have known that labyrinths within fiction was interesting until mm-hmm. he starts describing it that way. I'm a big fan of this author. And, you know, he writes short fiction, but he doesn't really do novels that
no.
really at all.
Yeah.
So it's just amazing that he can get these kind of bizarre ideas through the page
exactly.
in short spaces.
Because it's like philosophy mm-hmm. contained in fiction.
Yeah.
Especially this idea of time.
It's worth noting, too, that the main meat of House of Leaves is kind of supposed to mimic an academic text.
Mm-hmm.
So that'll be interesting to talk about once we get to that.
All right. Thank you, Jamie. So that is The Garden of Forking Paths by Jorge Luis Borges. We will move on to me, and I'm here to talk about, I was delighted when I heard we were going to talk about meta literature because one of my two favorite books is Breakfast of Champions by Kurt Vonnegut. And I was delighted that I could pull it off the shelf and talk about it. So Breakfast of Champions is a novel. It is about two men that have lives that sort of intersect at the climax. One of them is Dwayne Hoover. He runs a Pontiac car lot in Indiana. And Kilgore Trout, a failed science fiction writer, I think from New York. And they are both going to attend this art symposium in Dwayne Hoover's hometown and the sort of events that lead up to that intersection. Now, the reason I consider it meta is because throughout the book, there are many times that the author engages with the reader. There are illustrations. There are a lot of descriptions. In the beginning of the book especially, there's a lot of descriptions about basic things that your average American would know, but he describes them so simply as to kind of force you to think about them. Like he uses the text of the national anthem, and while you're reading this, you're like, I know this. He doesn't need to explain what this is. But then you start to wonder, well, why did he put it in the book? Why am I reading these words? It kind of draws that out of you. He loves to begin paragraphs here and there with the word listen. And he will write listen and then a colon and then start a new chapter or something like that. Like, of course I'm listening. It's a book. I'm here to read what your words have to say. You don't have to tell me to listen. Mm-hmm. But he does these things. And then towards the end, near the climax, the author actually inserts himself in the story. He says, this character is me. I'm sitting at a table. I'm drinking a martini behind glasses because I want to see the scene that I am about to write. Characters interact with him in minor ways while he's a member of the story. Mm-hmm. And it's very interesting when characters interact with him or he interacts with the world while describing to us in the text that I know what will happen or I control what this character does mm-hmm. because we can't forget that he is the author of the book. So it works on these two levels. One is the novel itself. It's just the story. of these two men. And the meta level, the upper level, is the author speaking to the reader, engaging with the reader, and then engaging down with the novel by putting himself as a character in it. It's a wonderfully miserable book. It is so simply written and almost lighthearted, but these two people lead miserable lives. One of them is slowly losing his mind to insanity, to schizophrenia. The other one is an old writer who never got credit for his work, and he has a very low opinion of himself and the world around him. And so they have these interactions with people where either the truth is being hidden or the characters are standoffish, they're guarded, and it leads to missed opportunities and bad relationships all throughout the book. There is an inspirational moment towards the end that is quite gripping, but other than that, it's kind of just bad people having a bad time for 300 pages, and sure. I adore it.
I guess one of the things that caught my attention was you mentioned that one of the characters is a writer that has a very low opinion of himself.
Mm-hmm.
Does, when Kurt Vonnegut introduces himself, does he seem to have a bias towards his own character in this book? Does it go at all into that? Because I feel like writing a character that's a writer, you are kind of talking about yourself in some
absolutely,
way.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. He does not touch on that in the book, right. But I think that parallel is easy to draw out, as you mm-hmm. did just moments ago.
Yeah.
Because Kurt Vonnegut was a very successful science fiction writer at this point in his life when he wrote this book. Mm-hmm. So writing a character who's a failed science fiction writer mm-hmm. isn't exactly autobiographical, but mm-hmm. maybe he feels that it is. Or maybe mm-hmm. there's part of him that feels like a failure,
mm-hmm.
and he wants to expose that in this book. So that's Breakfast of Champions by Kurt Vonnegut. Again, one of my favorite books of all time, so I recommend anybody read it. If you're not experienced with Vonnegut, it's a very personal place to start reading Vonnegut's books with Breakfast of Champions. All right, so Tony, what do you have for us that's meta today?
Sure. Well, I'm sharing about American Movie. It is a documentary film about an independent filmmaker who is in love with horror films and the trials and tribulations of how he makes a 38-minute short, but he's producing it completely with money from his community and completely with volunteers from his community, and it really delves deep into his own personal life. So it's really about the creator, definitely more so than the movie itself. But it also talks a lot about filmmaking, and that's why I think this is definitely has that layer of meta in that it's a filmmaker that is doing this almost guerrilla-style filmmaking, throughout the 90s, where he's just using, the bare-bones equipment, and he has such a strong vision of what he wants. He's not an uneducated person. In fact, the beginning of the movie is very revelatory in that it shows kind of his whole bookshelf of all the different film, books he's read. And one of the things that's kind of striking also is that even though he might be from, a small town near Milwaukee, and it seems as if he's like maybe at the lower end of the socioeconomic ladder, he happens to portray himself in this movie. He happens to like hold himself with a lot of dignity and uses a lot of a really good vocabulary. I mean, he's joking a lot of times, it seems like almost for the camera, which I didn't notice the first time I saw this film. One of the things he'll do is, for example, when he's doing casting calls for his movie, and just so you know, it's kind of like a mixture of documentary and comedy because it has inspiring moments, but it's also funny to see people interacting as they normally do in their home environments. But one of the things he says is, like, they're making a mockery of my words when people are trying out for his movie. So to me, it's just like he has such high regard for his creation, and yet he doesn't have any of the materials to, like, make it mm-hmm. into reality right now. So it just takes him such a long time, and it is such a struggle. So the movie is inspiring in that way because it takes you through an entire struggle of he's had these visions and he's been a filmmaker since a very young age. And one of the things that it does is it even shows film from when he was recording as a child, like as a teenager and younger. I mean, there are these themes that keep kind of cropping up in it. And like one of them is addressed and made apparent right in the beginning. It's like alcohol is kind of a central thing that might be holding him back. So it's mm-hmm. it's not a film about him gripping with that. But you can kind of see it lurking in the background. So it's really interesting how the film will show you those moments. And you may at one time think they're funny, but then going back, you can be like, oh, that's really sad, watching him kind of struggle with that just a little bit and like feeling like he's distant from his dream at different times. So he gets funding through his uncle, who is also not really sure that the money's going to a good place. But Mark Brochard, the subject of the film, just is so darn determined. And he's extremely polarizing because of how determined he is. And he ends up, you know, with a lot of people that support him and that will act in his film and that will be extras, etc. And then the same amount of people that really know him well, and they're just like, oh, I wish Mark would just stop with the, you know, films and things. So it's interesting to see that, and I think it's a very personal film, and I think the fact that it's called American Movie is very much a title that brings up the idea of, like, American dream, that you can do something if you have a vision for it and sticking to it. So, again, meta because it's self-aware, but also because the main subject of the film, Mark, is, like, really knowledgeable and self-aware of that he's being filmed to make this film.
Sure.
So he does a good job being himself, I guess, and being passionate and actually being entertaining, which at first I thought was just him being him, but I think it's that he, since he is an actor, he can play up the drama even more. So
it's like him, but him as a role of him, you know, separate.
Right.
Yeah, there's two strong aspects of meta literature here, and one is it's self-aware. And the other is, it's a thing about a thing, right? It's a movie about a movie.
Yeah.
You could have one or the other, but this one has both. And that's pretty compelling. It's kind of funny because the performances in the movie are bad, but then you realize that they're bad on purpose.
Sure.
It's because it's people acting like normal people or trying to act like actors that aren't good. And it's...
When people are like, oh, be natural for this picture. And then you're all trying to be like extremely like doing what you were doing kind of a thing.
Yeah, it's like I watched the first half and I'm like, I don't get it. This movie's not very good. And then when I started to realize, oh, all of this is intentional. And that's when I really started. Of course it's intentional. It's a movie. Yeah. You know, you don't just put a movie together by accident. Clearly all this was planned and all this was directed. And that's when it snapped in my head. And I realized, like, this is great. I've never seen anything like this. I've never seen, I rarely have seen something as compelling as this movie.
And if you do watch this movie and end up liking it, Errol Morris does a documentary called Vernon, Florida. And it's very similar in a way. It's short. It's only maybe like 70 minutes. But it's similar in a way that he's in a small town that he probably shouldn't be as a documentary filmmaker, a very small town in Florida, and he's just kind of just placing a camera in the middle of everybody's life. And people change in front of a camera. I mean, it's especially in an era where it means something to be on TV or, you know, it means something to be recorded. So it's just interesting to hear what people will say and what they'll say almost to seem like they're getting a rise out of you or, you know. So that's just another, like, one down this, a similar format. I'm not sure if it was probably made before this particular movie, but I don't know. I'm a big fan of documentary movies, and ones that call attention to that, their documentaries are always nice. So,
it's interesting what you were saying, Dave, about how at the beginning you weren't into it because you're like, what's happening? What's going on? And I think books or movies or TV shows or whatever that are meta can have very polarizing reactions from the audience because in some ways you're breaking down this fourth wall and you're changing the rules or the dynamics in some ways. I mean, meta is carried out in different ways, but sometimes if you want that suspension of disbelief, if that's what you're craving in a book or something, having that meta level might be disconcerting or people can't get into that.
Sure. It's less escapist.
Yeah.
I think just as a rule, because it requires that you consider the author, you consider the work behind it, you consider the act of creating this book or creating this movie. When I watch an action movie, most of the time I just want to enjoy the movie and just be a part of the story. Whereas with something that has a meta narrative, you're really invested and you're really putting forth, like you said, non-trivial effort to enjoy this. And sometimes that can be phenomenal. Like, I think we've all really felt strongly about what we've discussed so far. And if it hadn't had that extra layer, maybe we wouldn't feel so strongly about these stories. But if you're willing to put in a little more effort once in a while and read something that is has a meta aspect to it, I think it can be really rewarding.
Because you're considering it in a context then, you know, that this media is not happening in a vacuum, that there are all these other things you get to consider, which is both expansive, but if you're not looking for it at that time, it can be, you know, not limiting necessarily, but it forces you to do that extra work, which I think is positive in most cases.
So that brings us to our discussion about House of Leaves. House of Leaves is a book that we have read in some capacity or another. I read it years ago when it first came out, and now, Jamie, I think you're reading it for the first time.
I read it in high school.
Oh, you did?
Okay. I did read it in high school, but when I read it in high school, I ignored one of the storylines, which was in the footnotes. So when I'm reading it again, because we're doing a book club on it, I am reading one of the storylines for the first time. The rest of them I've already read. But the way that's happening is because House of Leaves is visually unlike most books that you will see.
Yes.
In that the typography and that the way it's organized is very unusual. And if one of you want to describe it better.
Yeah. So, and I'm reading it for the first time and I get to enjoy two storylines written on the same page. So what Jamie meant by an entire story being in the footnotes, you'll get the first section of the book. The majority, actually, of the book is called The Navidson Record, and it is kind of a meta-text. It's a book found by another character. So it's a book written by Zampano, and it is found by a character named Johnny Truant. So Johnny Truant's footnotes are in the book as a text that exists right next to or below all of Zampano's text. So you're getting Johnny's story, and you're getting Zampano's story. As the story kind of ramps up and you get into maybe more intense psychological situations, you'll actually end up with the text itself moving around on the page to one side or the other, or maybe instead of footnotes, there'll be maybe three lines of text at the top of the page, and then the bottom of the page will be empty for the next few pages. Or you'll get footnotes that include Johnny Truant, but then also include texts that are either made up or texts that are real, but maybe they're misquoted or translations of things in the main text. And sometimes these footnotes stretch on for pages. So it's very unpredictable, and it very much plays with your expectations in that you're not really sure what you should be reading even. Like, I don't blame you at all for not reading the footnotes the first time because they're in a different font. And honestly, the story has nothing to do with the Navidson Record. The Navidson Record is about a documentary film, which again is another media inside of this media, but it's an academic text written about a documentary film. So.
And each layer of narrator isn't sure if this movie actually exists or not. So each one is seeing the narrator below as a unreliable narrator, like what is true, what isn't. So there is this uncertainty, which I think is the uncanniness of the book, because it is, in some ways, a horror story. It gives this feeling of unease.
And that's because of the subject matter of, really, the house is maybe the one constant with throughout, obviously, Johnny's story as well, because Johnny is reading Zampano's account. But the house is supposedly, and this is just the barest hint that we could possibly give you, the house is supposedly larger inside than it is on the outside, because when Navidson is looking through the house and recording it, this is one of the first things he realizes. And the horror that ensues is more of a suspenseful and psychological horror seen through the eyes of the characters in this film.
So let me see if I have this straight. It's been a while since I've read the book, but if someone is reading House of Leaves for the first time, they are reading a book called House of Leaves. That is the story of Johnny, who is reading a book by Zampano, which is about a documentary, which is filmed by Navidson.
And it's about his own house.
So talk about layers, and it's about the house. So the House of Leaves itself.
And then on the outside, it says, you know, by Mark Z. Danielewski. But if you open the first page on the inside, it'll say Mark Z. Danielewski's House of Leaves by Zampano with introduction and notes by Johnny Truant. So if you're giving this a very brief look, it's very unclear like who the actual author is, who has created this book. And if you're reading it, it also is kind of unclear like who is the real narrative presence here, who is actually telling this story, because we get so many views that diverge from each other. But it's interesting because the essence of this book is a structure, the House of Leaves, the house that is not what it seems. It's different on the inside than the outside. And then we have this book itself. Well, so the book is the actual House of Leaves, but that is different, you know, that it too kind of moves and shifts and changes. And there are photos in it. There's fake interviews. And when I say fake interviews, I don't even mean that, you know, they didn't happen in our real world, but that people inside the book aren't really sure if these happened or not, or some people believe they did and some believe that they didn't. And, you know, if there's a fire, then some pages look burned. The text will get bigger, you know, huge fonts, tiny, tiny font. So you have to be ready to sink your teeth into it.
Yes, you do.
I think.
But that's phenomenal. It's unlike anything I've ever read. Mm-hmm. Back, it came out in 2000, and I don't think anyone's duplicated anything like this.
It has
some themes that are consistent, and I think that's one of the real strengths of this book, is that if the narrative was a mess and the authors are unreliable and even the concepts were unclear, I think it would all fall apart. But there's several themes that are strong. For me, there was a sense of dread for like every level of character in this book. There's a level of dread for there's the people in the house and the house is not what it seems. And I'm like, oh my goodness, are demons going to gobble them up? I don't know what's going to happen to the Navidsons. And then you go one above and it's Zampano who reports these things that may not exist. He's talking about a documentary that Johnny can't find evidence of. So I'm worried that is Zampano crazy? Did he make all this up or is this fiction? Or, you know, does he know something that I don't know? And then Johnny himself starts to become isolated from the outside world, becomes obsessed with this manuscript that he found by Zampano. And so I'm worried about Johnny. Is he going to be okay? Is he going to stop eating and you know, become a recluse, become a hermit because he's so affected by this book? And so on every level, I'm worried about these people. I'm worried about these authors, and sometimes physically or sometimes emotionally or sometimes mentally, about how will these people make it through this story and how will it end, and will they be okay, or will some of them be okay and some of them not be okay?
Yeah, because you definitely get the sense, like you're saying, that this house, either the house or the documents about the house, however removed, are literally swallowing the people up that are touching it. You know, we see, like you were saying, we see Johnny Truen's like psychological kind of deterioration as he gets more involved with this story. So, you know, in a much more complex way, I think about that other horror movie, The Ring, where everyone who watches this VHS tape kind of, it's kind of a contagion where it infects you. And in some way, that's kind of how this is like this house infects the people who are working with it, even if at 10 steps removed.
And the haunting part is that we're talking so enthusiastically and we're asking you to pick up this book, thus spreading the contagion even further. Because when you do get to a certain point in this book, you don't want to stop. That's the strange part, is that even though it's more overwhelming than it is than it was when you began, for some reason you're okay with that. You're okay with essentially lists of maybe art critics or something that are streaming down each side of the page and mirror text somewhere in floating in windows, kind of right in the middle, interrupting all the other text that you're reading. Yet you have this compulsion to complete the story and to get some resolution. But strangely enough, the mystery itself is almost what's fascinating. Like, you don't even need a resolution. But I'm extremely compelled to continue because
the way Johnny is in the book, the way he's compelled to finish the book, we feel the same compulsion.
And going back to that idea of ergodic literature where you need the strong effort, it talks about how the reader becomes integrated with this text. So I think that's part of what made me obsessively continue it in that, because then I felt like above Mark Z. Danielewski, like there was me reading and interpreting this text, because there's so many different layers that the way I read it could be completely different than the way either of you read it. Because, again, the first time I read it, didn't read any of Johnny Truant's parts. Now, when I'm reading it the second time, my interpretation will be different. And even if I had read that part last time, it still will be different, because there's ways that you interpret the colors and then their arrangement on the pages and how we make the links to each other.
Yeah, if there's text on the page and then there's a footnote and then there's a scrap of paper on the side, who knows who reads what in what order?
Exactly. So it gives us so many different paths we could go through. And I think that is exciting, but it is also frightening in a way, because with reading, we're used to linearity. We're used to being able to follow something, you know, very straightforwardly, where one word directly comes after another. And I had a woman today, again, we're doing this for a book group, so an older woman came to return the book, and she said, "This book sucks." And she was like, "I don't know what it's about and everything," but she did say that it's probably good once you could actually figure out what it's about. But she couldn't get to that point, so she returned it. And I think books like this, you either very strongly like it or mm-hmm. you very strongly dislike it.
Yeah. Well, and that can be on a number of things. Mm-hmm. I would not read it just before bed.
No.
You know, if you're looking for something pleasant to read, if you're looking for a vacation read, you might not like this book, but you might like this book in other situations. So like even the reader itself, maybe depending on when you read, may or may not mm-hmm. like it, or, you know, how ready you are to be engaged by it. It is large and confusing, and mm-hmm. you need to be okay with that. And some people are, some people aren't. Some people maybe will be right now. Some people maybe aren't right now, and we'll get to it later.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think it's funny you say that because I almost have like an inverse of her reaction to this book, is that it engages my mind on multiple levels mm-hmm. so that I don't, maybe because I am, you know, maybe a multitasker and that I almost need this stimulation from mm-hmm. different things. It's more engaging than a straightforward linear storyline mm-hmm. where I only get a handful, given there aren't an uncountable number of characters in this book. Mm-hmm. But it was, once you get into a certain point, 30, 40, not even 50 pages in, there's a concrete story that you can follow. Well, two stories you can follow. Yeah, that was actually a point that I liked about it. So yeah, it'll be different for different people. So.
And I think it's more similar to how we read things on the internet now, in terms of, you know, different things pop up at once. Mm-hmm. We go back and forth through between multiple tabs. And it's not, you know, just like reading a newspaper where we read it in a discrete order. Mm-hmm. And people thought, I remember in the 90s, people thought that hypertext or these different ways of doing literature where you can click on all these links and mm-hmm. it's kind of like mm-hmm. choose your own adventure would become really popular. And it didn't. And today when I was trying to go back and look at all those links, all of them are dead links. They go, mm-hmm. you know, they sold the domain somewhere else. And,
oh, sure.
Or they say, you know, oh, you can get this on CD-ROM, send $9 to X, Y, or Z. And so I think this is really great because it kind of recreates that idea of, you know, clicking on different links. Mm-hmm. You can go different places, but it's actually in an artifact.
Mm-hmm. That's a really good point. Yeah, because it'll often refer back to page 153 or appendix mm-hmm. 2. Mm-hmm. You know, like, that's a really good point.
So that's House of Leaves. It is going to be our book discussion group for the Pint and Click, whatever the Halloween
discussion. It's a haunted discussion.
Historic
campgrounds on October 22nd. So this might actually air before then.
So if you're looking for a copy, we still might have them on the third floor.
No, we do not have any.
We don't. They're gone.
They're all gone.
We might even be completely booked. We're talking about that right now, which is a good thing.
But
it's exciting.
It's a good thing, yeah.
How exciting. Yeah. So we recommend it. We love it. Maybe you'll love it too. Maybe not. If not,
but
that's
okay.
But you
have a strong opinion about it.
You will have a strong opinion about this book one way or the other. All right. Well, that does it for us here. Jamie has told me that I must self-congratulate. I got married over the weekend.
Woo!
So shout out to my lovely wife for a quick marriage and a quick return to work on Monday.
Well, quick wedding, long marriage, right?
Oh, yes. No, certainly. Excuse me. So that'll do it for us at the Pint and Click podcast. We'll see you next time.